Side 11. She had been in a deep sleep and was momentarily disoriented. But she quickly turned on the bedside light, and after a moment gave instructions for senior Argus staff to be assembled. She would, she told him, locate Jaheer, who was somewhere on the facility. This proved not very difficult. She shook his shoulder. Ken, get up. There's word that we've repeated.
What?
The message has cycled back. Or at least, that's what Willie says. I'm on my way there. Why don't you wait another 10 minutes so we can pretend you were in your room in BSQ? She was almost at the door before he shouted after her.
How can we recycle? We haven't gotten the primer yet.
Racing across the screens was a paired sequence of zeros and ones, a real-time comparison of the data just being received and the data from an early page of text received at Argus a year before. The program would have culled out any differences. So far, there were none. It reassured them that they had not mistranscribed, that there were no apparent transmission errors, and that if some small, dense interstellar cloud between Vega and the Earth was able to eat the occasional zero or one, this was an infrequent occurrence. Argus was by now in real-time communication with dozens of other telescopes that were part of the World Message Consortium, and the news of recycling was passed on to the next observing stations westward, to California, Hawaii, the Marshall Nedelin now in the South Pacific, and to Sydney. Had the discovery been made when Vega was over one of the other telescopes in the network, Argus would have been informed instantly. The absence of the primer was an agonizing disappointment, but it was not the only surprise. The message page numbers had jumped discontinuously from the 40,000s to the 10,000s, where recycling had been uncovered. Evidently, Argus had discovered the transmission from Vega almost at the moment it first arrived at Earth. It was a remarkably strong signal, and would have been picked up even by small, omnidirectional telescopes. But it was a surprising coincidence that the broadcast should arrive at Earth at the very moment Argus was looking at Vega. Also, what did it mean for the text to begin on a page in the 10,000s? Were there 10,000 pages of text missing? Was it a backward practice of the provincial Earth to start numbering books on page one? Were these sequential numbers perhaps not page numbers, but something else? Or, and this worried Ellie the most, was there some fundamental and unexpected difference between how humans thought of things and how the aliens thought? If so, it would have worrisome implications about the ability of the consortium to understand the message, primer or no primer. The message repeated exactly. The gaps were all filled in and nobody could read a word of it. It seemed unlikely that the transmitting civilization, meticulous in all else, had simply overlooked the need for a primer. At least the Olympic broadcast and the interior design of the machine seemed to be tailored specifically for humans. They would hardly go to all this trouble to devise and transmit the message without making some provision for humans to read it. So humans must have overlooked something. It soon became generally agreed that somewhere was a fourth layer to the palimpsest. But where? The diagrams were published in an 8-volume coffee table book set that was soon reprinted worldwide. All over the planet, people tried to figure out the pictures. The dodecahedron and the quasi-biological forms were especially evocative. Many clever suggestions were made by the public and carefully sifted by the Argus team. Many harebrained interpretations were also widely available, especially in weekly newspapers. Whole new industries developed, doubtless unforeseen by those who devised the message, dedicated to using the diagrams to bilk the public. The ancient and mystical order of the dodecahedron was announced. The machine was a UFO. The machine was Ezekiel's wheel. An angel revealed the meaning of the message in the diagrams to a Brazilian businessman who distributed, at first at his own expense, his interpretation worldwide. With so many enigmatic diagrams to interpret, it was inevitable that many religions would recognize some of their iconography in the message from the stars. A principal cross-section of the machine looked something like a chrysanthemum, a fact that stirred great enthusiasm in Japan. if there had been an image of a human face among all the diagrams, messianic fervor might have reached a flashpoint. As it was, a surprisingly large number of people were winding up their affairs in preparation for the advent. Industrial productivity was off worldwide. Many had given away all their possessions to the poor, and then, as the end of the world was delayed, were obliged to seek help from a charity or the state. Because gifts of this sort constituted a major fraction of the resources of such charities, some of the philanthropists ended up being supported by their own gifts. Delegations approached government leaders to urge that schistomiasis, say, or world hunger be ended by the advent. Otherwise, there was no telling what would happen to us. Others counseled more quietly that if there was a decade of real world madness in the offing, there must be a considerable monetary or national advantage in it somewhere. Some said that there was no primer, that the whole exercise was to teach humans humility or to drive us mad. There were newspaper editorials on how we're not as smart as we think we are, and some resentment directed at the scientists, who, after all the support given to them by the governments, have failed us in our time of need. Or maybe humans are much dumber than the Vegans gave us credit for. Maybe there was some point that had been entirely obvious to all previous emerging civilizations so contacted, something no one in the history of the galaxy had ever missed before. A few commentators embraced this prospect of cosmic humiliation with real enthusiasm. It demonstrated what they'd been saying about people all along. After a while, Ellie decided that she needed help. They entered surreptitiously through the Enlil gate, with an escort dispatched by the proprietor. The General Services Administration security detail was edgy, despite or perhaps because of the additional protection. Although there was a little sunlight still left, the dirt streets were lit by braziers, oil lamps, and an occasional guttering torch. Two amphoras, each large enough to contain an adult human being, flanked the entrance to a retail olive oil establishment. The advertising was in cuneiform. On an adjacent public building was a magnificent bas-relief of a lion hunt from the reign of Assurbanipal. As they approached the Temple of Assur, there was a scuffle in the crowd, and her escort made a wide berth. She now had an unobstructed view of the ziggurat down a wide, torch-lit avenue. It was more breathtaking than in the pictures. There was a martial flourish on an unfamiliar brass instrument. Three men and a horse clattered by, the charioteer in Phrygian headdress. As in some medieval rendition of a cautionary tale from the Book of Genesis, the top of the ziggurat was enveloped in low, twilight clouds. They left the Ishtarian Way and entered the ziggurat through a side street. In the private elevator, her escort pressed the button for the topmost floor. 40, it read. No numerals, just the word. And then, to leave no room for doubt, a glass panel flashed, "The Gods." Mr. Haddon would be with her shortly. Would she like something to drink while she waited? Considering the reputation of the place, Ellie demurred. Babylon lay spread out before her, magnificent, as everyone said, in its recreation of a long-gone time and place. During daylight hours, busloads from museums, a very few schools, and the tourist agencies would arrive at the Ishtar Gate, don appropriate clothes, and travel back in time. Haddon wisely donated all profits from his daytime clientele to New York City and Long Island charities. The daytime tours were immensely popular, in part because it was a respectable opportunity to look the place over for those who would not dream of visiting Babylon at night. Well, maybe they would dream. After dark, Babylon was called an adult amusement park. It was of an opulence, scale, and imaginativeness that dwarfed, say, the Reeperbahn in Hamburg. It was by far the largest tourist attraction in the New York metropolitan area, with by far the largest gross revenues. How Haddon had been able to convince the city fathers of Babylon, New York, and how he had lobbied for an easement of local and state prostitution laws was well known. It was now a half-hour train ride from Midtown Manhattan to the Ishtar Gate. Ellie had insisted on taking this train, despite the entreaties of the security people, and had found almost a third of the visitors to be women. There were no graffiti, little danger of mugging, but a much inferior brand of white noise compared with the conveyances of the New York City subway system. Although Haddon was a member of the National Academy of Engineering, he had never, so far as Ellie knew, attended a meeting, and she had never set eyes on him. His face became well known to millions of Americans, however, years before, as a result of the Advertising Council's campaign against him. "The Un-American" had been the caption under an unflattering portrait of Haddon. Even so, she was taken aback when in the midst of her reverie by the slanted glass wall she was interrupted by a small, fat, beckoning person. "Oh, sorry. I never understand how anyone can be afraid of me." His voice was surprisingly musical. In fact, he seemed to talk in fifths. He hadn't thought it necessary to introduce himself, and once again inclined his head to the door he had left ajar. It was hard to believe that some crime of passion was about to be visited upon her under these circumstances, and wordlessly, she entered the next room. He ushered her to a meticulously crafted tabletop model of an ancient city of less pretentious aspect than Babylon. "Pompeii," he said by way of explanation. "The stadium here is the key. With the restrictions on boxing, there aren't any healthy blood sports left in America. Very important. Sucks out some of the poisons from the national bloodstream. The whole thing is designed, permits issued, and now this."
"What's this?"
"No gladiatorial games. I just got word from Sacramento. There's a bill before the legislature to outlaw gladiatorial games in California. Too violent, they say. They authorize a new skyscraper. They know they'll lose two or three construction workers. The unions know. The builders know. And that's just to build offices for oil companies or Beverly Hills lawyers. Oh, sure, we'd lose a few. But we're geared more to trident and net than the short sword. Those legislators don't have their priorities straight." He beamed at her owlishly and offered a drink, which again she refused. "So you want to talk to me about the machine. And I want to talk to you about the machine. You first. You want to know where the primer is? We're asking for help from a few key people who might have some insight. We thought with your record of invention, and since your context recognition chip was involved in the recycling discovery, that you might put yourself in the place of the Vegans and think of where you'd put the primer. We recognize you're very busy, and I'm sorry to..." "Oh, no, it's all right. It's true, I'm busy. I'm trying to regularize my affairs, because I'm going to make a big change in my life." "For the millennium?" She tried to imagine him giving away S.R. Haddon and Company, the Wall Street brokerage house, Genetic Engineering Incorporated, Haddon Cybernetics, and Babylon to the poor. "Not exactly. No. It was fun to think about. It made me feel good to be asked. I looked at the diagrams." He waved at the commercial set of 8 volumes spread in disarray on a work table. "There are wonderful things in there. But I don't think that's where the primer is hiding. Not in the diagrams. I don't know why you think the primer has to be in the message. Maybe they left it on Mars or Pluto or in the Oort comet cloud. And we'll discover it in a few centuries. Right now, we know there's this wonderful machine with design drawings and 30,000 pages of explanatory text. But we don't know whether we'd be able to build the thing if we could read it. So we wait a few centuries, improving our technology, knowing that sooner or later we'll have to be ready to build it. Not having the primer binds us up with future generations. Human beings are sent a problem that takes generations to solve. I don't think that's such a bad thing. Might be very healthy. Maybe you're making a mistake looking for a primer. Maybe it's better not to find it." "No, I want to find the primer right away. We don't know it'll be waiting for us forever. If they hang up because there was no answer, it would be much worse than if they'd never called at all." "Well, maybe you have a point. Anyway, I thought of as many possibilities as I could. I'll give you a couple of trivial possibilities and then a non-trivial possibility. Trivial first. The primer's in the message, but at a very different data rate. Suppose there was another message in there, at a bit an hour.
Could you detect that?
Absolutely. We routinely check for long-term receiver drift in any case. But also a bit an hour only buys you, let me see, 10,000-20,000 bits tops before the message recycles.
So that makes sense, only if the primer is much easier than the message.
You think it isn't. I think it isn't. Now, what about much faster bit rates? How do you know that under every bit of your machine message, there aren't a million bits of primer message?
Because it would produce monster bandwidths. We'd know in an instant.
Okay. So there's a fast data dump every now and then. Think of it as microfilm. There's a tiny dot of microfilm that's sitting in repetitive parts of the message. I'm imagining a little box that says in your regular language, I am the primer. Then right after that, there's a dot. And in that dot is 100 million bits, very fast. You might see if you've got any boxes.
Believe me, we would have seen it.
Okay, how about phase modulation? We use it in radar and spacecraft telemetry, and it hardly messes up the spectrum at all.
Have you hooked up a phase correlator?
No, that's a useful idea. I'll look into it. Now, the non-trivial idea is this. If the machine ever gets made, if our people are going to sit in it, somebody's going to press a button, and then those five are going to go somewhere. Never mind where. Now, there's an interesting question whether those five are going to come back. Maybe not. I like the idea that all this machine design was invented by vegan body snatchers. You know, they're medical students or anthropologists or something. They need a few human bodies. Oh, it's a big hassle to come to Earth. You need permission, passes from the transit authority. Oh, hell, it's more trouble than it's worth. But with a little effort, you can send the Earth a message. And then the Earthlings go to all the trouble to ship you five bodies. It's like stamp collecting. I used to collect stamps when I was a kid. You could send a letter to somebody in a foreign country, and most of the time they'd write back. It didn't matter what they said. All you wanted was a stamp. So that's my picture. There's a few stamp collectors on Vega. They send letters out when they're in the mood, and bodies come flying back to them from all over space. Wouldn't you like to see the collection? He smiled up at her and continued, okay. So what does this have to do with finding the primer?
Nothing.
It's relevant only if I'm wrong. If my picture is wrong, if the five people are coming back to Earth, then it would be a big help if we've invented spaceflight. No matter how smart they are, it's going to be tough to land the machine. Too many things are moving. God knows what the propulsion system is. If you pop out of space a few meters below ground, you've had it. And what's a few meters in 26 light years? It's too risky. When the machine comes back, it'll pop out, or whatever it does, in space, somewhere near the Earth. But not on it, or in it. So they have to be sure we have spaceflight, so the five people can be rescued in space. They're in a hurry and can't sit tight until the 1957 evening news arrives on Vega. So what do? They arrange so part of the message can only be detected from space. What part is that? The primer. If you can detect the primer, you've got spaceflight, and you can come back safe. So I imagine the primer is being sent at the frequency of the oxygen absorptions in the microwave spectrum, or in the near-infrared. Some part of the spectrum you can't detect until you're well out of the Earth's atmosphere. We've had the Hubble telescope looking at Vega all through the ultraviolet, visible and near-infrared. Not a hint of anything. The Russians have repaired their millimeter wave instrument. They've hardly been looking at anything besides Vega, and they haven't found anything. But we'll keep looking. Other possibilities? Sure you wouldn't like a drink? I don't drink myself, but so many people do. Ellie again declined. No other possibilities. And now it's my turn. You see, I want to ask you for something. But I'm not good at asking for things. I never have been. My public image is rich, funny-looking, unscrupulous. Somebody who looks for weaknesses in the system so he can make a fast buck. And don't tell me you don't believe any of that. Everybody believes at least some of it. You've probably heard some of what I'm going to say before, but give me 10 minutes and I'll tell you how all this began.
I want you to know something about me. She settled back, wondering what he could possibly want of her, and brushed away idle fantasies involving the Temple of Ishtar, Hadden, and perhaps a charioteer or two thrown in for good measure. Years before, he had invented a module that, when a television commercial appeared, automatically muted the sound. It wasn't at first a context recognition device. Instead, it simply monitored the amplitude of the carrier wave. TV advertisers had taken to running their ads louder and with less audio clutter than the programs that were their nominal vehicles. News of Haddon's module spread by word of mouth. People reported a sense of relief, the lifting of a great burden, even a feeling of joy at being freed from the advertising barrage for the 6 to 8 hours out of every day that the average American spent in front of the television set. Before there could be any coordinated response from the television advertising industry, AdNics had become wildly popular. It forced advertisers and networks into new choices of carrier wave strategy, each of which had encountered with a new invention. Sometimes he invented circuits to defeat strategies that the agencies and the networks had not yet hit upon. He would say that he was saving them the trouble of making inventions, at great cost to their shareholders, which were at any rate doomed to failure. As his sales volume increased, he kept cutting prices. It was a kind of electronic warfare, and he was winning. They tried to sue him, something about a conspiracy and restraint of trade. They had sufficient political muscle that his motion for summary dismissal was denied, but insufficient influence to actually win the case. The trial had forced Haddon to investigate the relevant legal codes. Soon after, he applied through a well-known Madison Avenue agency in which he was now a major silent partner to advertise his own product on commercial television. After a few weeks of controversy, his commercials were refused. He sued all three networks, and in this trial was able to prove conspiracy in restraint of trade. He received a huge settlement that was at the time a record for cases of this sort, and which contributed, in its modest way, to the demise of the original networks. There had always been people who enjoyed the commercials, of course, and they had no need for AdNics. But they were a dwindling minority. Haddon made a great fortune by eviscerating broadcast advertising. He also made many enemies. By the time context recognition chips were commercially available, he was ready with PreachNics, a sub-module which could be plugged into AdNics. It would simply switch channels if, by chance, a doctrinaire religious program should be tuned in. You could pre-select keywords such as Advent or Rapture and cut great swathes through the available programming. PreachNics was a godsend for a long-suffering but significant minority of television viewers. There was talk, some of it half-serious, that Haddon's next sub-module would be called JiveNics and would work only on public addresses by presidents and premiers. As he further developed context recognition chips, it became obvious to him that they had much wider applications, from education, science, and medicine to military intelligence and industrial espionage. It was on this issue that the lines were drawn for the famous suit United States versus Haddon Cybernetics. One of Haddon's chips was considered too good for civilian life, and on recommendation of the National Security Agency, the facilities and key personnel for the most advanced context recognition chip production were taken over by the government. It was simply too important to read the Russian mail. God knows, they told him, what would happen if the Russians could read our mail. Haddon refused to cooperate in the takeover and vowed to diversify into areas that could not possibly be connected with national security. The government was nationalizing industry, he said. They claimed to be capitalists, but when push came to shove, they showed their socialist face. He had found an unsatisfied public need and employed an existing and legal new technology to deliver what they wanted. It was classic capitalism. But there were many sober capitalists who would tell you that he had already gone too far with AdNics, that he had posed a real threat to the American way of life. In a dour column signed V. Petrov,
Pravda called it a concrete example of the contradictions of capitalism. The Wall Street Journal countered, perhaps a little tangentially, by calling Pravda, which in Russian means truth, a concrete example of the contradictions of communism. He suspected that the takeover was only a pretext, that his real offense had been to attack advertising and video evangelism. Adniks and Prechniks were the essence of capitalist entrepreneurship, he argued repeatedly. The point of capitalism was supposed to be providing people with alternatives. Well, the absence of advertising is an alternative, I told them. There are huge advertising budgets only when there's no difference between the products. If the products really were different, people would buy the one that's better. Advertising teaches people not to trust their judgment. Advertising teaches people to be stupid. A strong country needs smart people. So Adniks is patriotic. The manufacturers can use some of their advertising budgets to improve their products. The consumer will benefit. Magazines and newspapers and direct mail business will boom, and that'll ease the pain in the ad agencies. I don't see what the problem is. Adniks, much more than the innumerable libel suits against the original commercial networks, led directly to their demise. For a while, there was a small army of unemployed advertising executives, down-and-out former network officials, and penniless divines who had sworn blood oaths to revenge themselves on Haddon. And there was an ever-growing number of still more formidable adversaries. Without a doubt, she thought, Haddon was an interesting man. So I figure it's time to go. I've got more money than I know what to do with. My wife can't stand me. And I've got enemies everywhere. I want to do something important. Something worthy. I want to do something so that hundreds of years from now people will look back and be glad I was around. You want to... I want to build a machine. Look, I'm perfectly suited for it. I've got the best cybernetics expertise, practical cybernetics in the business. Better than Carnegie Mellon, better than MIT, better than Stanford, better than Santa Barbara. And if there's anything clear from those plans, it's that this isn't a job for an old-time tool-and-die maker. And you're going to need something like genetic engineering. You won't find anybody more dedicated to this job. And I'll do it at cost. Really, Mr. Haddon, who builds the machine, if we ever get to that point, isn't up to me. It's an international decision. All sorts of politics is involved. They're still debating in Paris about whether to build the thing, if and when we decrypt the message. Don't you think I know that? I'm also applying through the usual channels of influence and corruption. I just want to have a good word put in for me for the right reasons, by the side of the angels. You understand? And speaking of angels, you really shook up Palmer Joss and Billy Joe Rankin. I haven't seen them so agitated since that trouble they had about Mary's Waters. Rankin saying he was deliberately misquoted about supporting the machine. My, my. He shook his head in mock consternation. That some long-standing personal enmity existed between these active proselytizers and the inventor of Prechniks seemed probable enough. And for some reason she was moved to their defense. They're both a lot smarter than you might think. And Palmer Joss is, well, there's something genuine about him. He's not a phony. You're sure it's not just another pretty face? Excuse me, but it's important that people understand their feelings on this. It's too important not to. I know these clowns. Underneath, when push comes to shove, they're jackals. A lot of people find religion attractive. You know, personally, sexually. You ought to see what happens in the Temple of Ishtar. She repressed a small shiver of revulsion. I think I will have that drink, she said. Looking down from the penthouse, she could see the gradated tiers of the ziggurat, each draped with flowers, some artificial, some real, depending on the season. It was a reconstruction of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Miraculously, it was so arranged that it did not closely resemble a Hyatt hotel. Far below, she could make out a torchlit procession headed back from the ziggurat to the Enlil gate. It was led by a kind of sedan chair, held by four burly men stripped to the waist. Who or what was in it she could not make out. It's a ceremony in honor of Gilgamesh, one of the ancient Sumerian culture heroes. Yes, I've heard of him. Immortality was his business. He said this matter-of-factly, by way of explanation, and looked at his watch. It's at the very top of the ziggurat, you know, that the kings would go to receive instruction from the gods, especially from Anu, the sky god. By the way, I looked up what they called Vega. It was Tirana, the life of heaven. It's a funny thing to call it. And have you gotten any instructions? No, they went to your place, not mine. But there'll be another Gilgamesh procession at 9 o'clock. I'm afraid I won't be able to stay that long. But let me ask you something. Why Babylon? She asked. And Pompeii? Here you are, one of the most inventive people around. You've created several major industries. You defeated the advertising industry on its own ground. Okay, so you got whipped on that security issue on the context recognition chip. There's lots of other things you could have done. Why this? Far away, the procession had reached the Temple of Asir. Why not something more worthy? He asked. I'm just trying to satisfy societal needs that the government overlooks or ignores. It's capitalism. It's legal. It makes a lot of people happy. And I think it's a safety valve for some of the crazies that this society keeps generating. But I didn't think all that through at the time. It's very simple. I can remember exactly the moment when the idea for Babylon hit me. I was in Walt Disney World, riding the Mississippi Sternwheeler riverboat with my grandson Jason. Jason was around 4, maybe 5. I was thinking about how smart the Disney people were to discontinue individual tickets for each ride and instead offer a one-day pass which admitted you to everything. They saved some salaries, some of the ticket takers, for instance. But much more important, people tended to overestimate their appetites for rides. They'd pay a premium to be admitted to everything, and then they'd be happy with a lot less. Now, next to me and Jason was an 8-year-old boy with a faraway look in his eye. I'm guessing his age. Maybe he was 10. His father was asking him stuff, and he was answering in monosyllables. The boy was fondling the barrel of a toy rifle he'd propped up on his deck chair. The stock was between his legs. All he wanted was to be left alone and stroke the rifle. Behind him were the towers and spires of the Magic Kingdom, and suddenly everything fell into place. You know what I'm saying? He filled a tumbler with Diet Cola and clicked it against her glass. Confusion to your enemies, he toasted genially. I'll have them take you out by the Ishtar Gate. The procession's going to make things too crowded toward the Enlil Gate. Both escorts magically appeared, and it was evident she was being dismissed. She had little desire to linger. Oh, don't forget about the phase modulation and looking in the oxygen lines. But even if I'm wrong about where the primer is, don't forget. I'm the only one to build the machine. Floodlights brilliantly illuminated the Ishtar Gate. It was covered with representations in glazed tile of some blue animal. The archaeologists had called them dragons. Chapter 14. Harmonic Oscillator. Skepticism is the chastity of the intellect, and it is shameful to surrender it too soon or to the first comer. There is nobility in preserving it coolly and proudly through long youth, until at last, in the ripeness of instinct and discretion, it can be safely exchanged for fidelity and happiness. George Santayana. Skepticism and Animal Faith. 9. It was on a mission of insurgency and subversion. The enemy was vastly larger and more powerful, but it knew the enemy's weakness. It could take over the alien government, turning the resources of the adversary to its own purpose. Now, with millions of dedicated agents in place,
She sneezed and tried to find a clean paper tissue in the bulging pocket of the terry cloth presidential bathrobe. She had no makeup on, although her chapped lips revealed patches of mentholated balm.
My doctor tells me I have to stay in bed or I'll get viral pneumonia. I ask him for an antibiotic and he tells me there's no antibiotic for viruses. So how does he know I have a virus?
Derheer opened his mouth to answer, a gesture in the making when the president cut him short.
No, never mind. You'll start telling me about DNA and host recognition and I'll need what resources I've got left to listen to your story. If you're not afraid of my virus, pull up a chair.
Thank you, Miss President. This is about the primer. I have the report here. There's a long technical section that's included as an appendix. I thought you might be interested in it also. Briefly, we're reading and actually understanding the thing with almost no difficulty. It's a fiendishly clever learning program. I don't mean fiendishly in any literal sense, of course. We must have a vocabulary of 3,000 words by now. I don't understand how it's possible. I could see how they could teach you the names of their numbers. You make one dot and write the letters O-N-E underneath, and so on. I could see how you could have a picture of a star and then write S-T-A-R under it, but I don't see how you could do verbs or the past tense or conditionals. Well, they do some of it with movies. Movies are perfect for verbs. And a lot of it they do with numbers. Even abstractions. They can communicate abstractions with numbers. It goes something like this. First they count out the numbers for us, and then they introduce some new words. Words we don't understand. Here, I'll indicate their words by letters. We read something like this. The letters stand for symbols the Vegans introduce. He wrote, 1A1B2Z, 1A2B3Z, 1A7B8Z. What do you think it is?
My high school report card.
You mean there's a combination of dots and dashes that A stands for, and a different combination of dots and dashes that B stands for, and so on? Exactly. You know what 1 and 2 mean, but you don't know what A and B mean. What does a sequence like this tell you? A means plus, and B means equals. Is that what you're getting at? Good. But we don't yet understand what Z means, right? Now, along comes something like this. 1A2B4Y. You see? Maybe. Give me another that ends in Y.
2000A4000B0Y.
Okay, I think I got it. As long as I don't read the last three symbols as a word, Z means it's true and Y means it's false. Right, exactly. Pretty good for a president with a virus and a South African crisis. So with a few lines of text, they've taught us four words. Plus, equals, true, false. Four pretty useful words. Then they teach division. Divide one by zero and tell us the word for infinity. Or maybe it's just the word for indeterminate. Or they say, the sum of the interior angles of a triangle is two right angles. Then they comment that the statement is true if space is flat, but false if space is curved. So you've learned how to say if, and I didn't know space was curved. Ken, what the hell are you talking about? How can space be curved? No, never mind, never mind. That can't have anything to do with the business in front of us. Well, actually, Saul Haddon tells me it was his idea where to find the primer. Don't look at me funny to hear. I talk to all types. I didn't mean, as I understand it, Mr. Haddon volunteered a few suggestions, which had all been made by other scientists as well. Dr. Arroway checked them out and hit pay dirt with one of them. It's called phase modulation, or phase coding. Yes. Now, is this correct, Ken? The primer is scattered throughout the message, right? Lots of repetitions. And there was some primer shortly after Arroway first picked up the signal. Shortly after she picked up the third layer of the palimpsest, the machine design. And many countries have the technology to read the primer, right? Well, they need a device called a phase correlator, but yes, the countries that count anyway. Then the Russians could have read the primer a year ago, right? Or the Chinese or the Japanese. How do you know they're not halfway to building the machine right now? I thought of that. But Marvin Yang says it's impossible. Satellite photography, electronic intelligence, people on the scene, all confirm that there's no sign of the kind of major construction project you'd need to build a machine. No. We've all been asleep at the switch. We were seduced by the idea that the primer had to come at the beginning and not interspersed through the message. It's only when the message recycled and we discovered it wasn't there that we started thinking of other possibilities. All this work has been done in close cooperation with the Russians and everybody else. We don't think anybody has the jump on us, but on the other hand, everybody has the primer now. I don't think there's any unilateral course of action for us. I don't want a unilateral course of action for us. I just want to make sure that nobody else has a unilateral course of action. Okay, so back to your primer. You know how to say true-false, if-then, and space is curved. How do you build a machine with that? You know, I don't think this cold or whatever you've got has slowed you down a bit. Well, it just takes off from there. For example, they draw us a periodic table of the elements. So they get to name all the chemical elements, the idea of an atom, the idea of a nucleus, protons, neutrons, electrons. Then they run through some quantum mechanics just to make sure we're paying attention. There are already some new insights for us in the remedial stuff. Then it starts concentrating on the particular materials needed for the construction. For example, for some reason we need 2 tons of erbium. So they run through a nifty technique to extract it from ordinary rocks. Derhir raised his hand palm outward in a placatory gesture. Don't ask why we need 2 tons of erbium. Nobody has the faintest idea. I wasn't going to ask that. I want to know how they told you how much a ton is. They counted it out for us in Planck masses. A Planck mass is... Never mind. It's something that physicists all over the universe know about, right? And I've never heard of it. Now, the bottom line. Do we understand the primer well enough to start reading the message? Will we be able to build the thing or not? The answer seems to be yes. We've only had the primer for a few weeks now, but whole chapters of the message are falling into our lap in clear. It's painstaking design, redundant explanations, and, as far as we can tell, tremendous redundancy in the machine design. We should have a 3-dimensional model of the machine for you in time for that crew selection meeting on Thursday, if you feel up to it. So far, we haven't a clue as to what the machine does or how it works. And there are some funny organic chemical components that don't make any sense as part of a machine. But almost everybody seems to think we can build the thing. Who doesn't? Well, Lunacharsky and the Russians. And Billy Joe Rankin, of course. There are still people who worry that the machine will blow up the world or tip the Earth's axis or something. But what's impressed most of the scientists is how careful the instructions are, and how many different ways they go about trying to explain the same thing. And what does Eleanor Arroway say? She says if they want to do us in, they'll be here in 25 years or so, and there's nothing we could do in 25 years to protect ourselves. They're too far ahead of us. So she says, build it, and if you're worried about environmental hazards, build it in a remote place. Professor Drumlin says you can build it in downtown Pasadena for all he cares. In fact, he says he'll be there every minute it takes to construct the machine, so he'll be the first to go if it blows up. Drumlin. He's the fellow who figured out that this was the design for a machine, right? Not exactly. I'll read all the briefing material in time for that Thursday meeting. You got anything else for me? Are you seriously considering letting Haddon build the machine? Well, it's not only up to me, as you know. That treaty they're hammering out in Paris gives us about a 1/4 say. The Russians have 1/4. The Chinese and the Japanese together have 1/4. And the rest of the world has 1/4, roughly speaking. A lot of nations want to build the machine, or at least parts of it. They're thinking about prestige and new industries, new knowledge. As long as no one gets a jump on us, that all sounds fine to me. It's possible Haddon might have a piece of it. What's the problem? Don't you think he's technically competent? Well, he certainly is. It's just... If there's nothing more, Ken, I'll see you Thursday. Virus willing. As Derhir was shutting the door and entering the adjacent sitting room, there was an explosive presidential sneeze. The warrant officer of the day, sitting stiffly on a couch, was visibly startled. The briefcase at his feet was crammed with authorization codes for nuclear war. Jurhir calmed him with a repetitive gesture of his hand. Fingers spread, palm down. The officer gave an apologetic smile. End of side 11.